97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Welcome back. 4 o'clock hour. A lot to get to, including a visit with Ryan Goebel, who's the captain of a charter boat by the name of Sea Trek One, and he is near Fort Myers, and he's moved his vessel upriver, we're told. He has Starlink, and we're going to talk with him about why he's trying to ride this thing out down there. And right now, we have meteorologist Dave Murray with us to kind of explain what's currently happening with Milton. Dave, how are you this afternoon?
Doing fine. How are you guys?
Good. You've covered a lot of these over your career, so how does this even compare? The size of this thing, just when you look at the radar, is just amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. This is a big storm. I'm not going to put it until it gets through and we see what happens with this thing. I'm not going to call it the worst ever because we've got Camille and we've got Katrina and we have some storms of the 50s and the 60s. We have Andrew that hit Florida. I mean, those were all vicious, vicious storms. I do think that probably the monetary numbers are going to be extreme only because of the population centers there and the growth that that part of Florida has had over the last 10, 15 years. It's also a part of Florida that doesn't get hit very often. Now, clearly, Fort Myers and Naples have been hit recently, but Tampa, St. Pete area, down towards Bradenton, doesn't get hit that often by a direct hit just because it's a weird phenomena that makes that happen.
So what's up with all the tornadoes that are occurring?
Not a surprise because of the power of this particular storm, but I've always explained a hurricane as a mass of thunderstorms that rotate around each other. So when the thing starts to interact with land, you have tremendous lift and tremendous downdrafts in these thunderstorms, and that creates severe thunderstorms that produce tornadoes. They're usually small spin-up tornadoes, not the big long-track stuff that we're used to in the Midwest, but they just kind of hit and do their thing, and then they lift back up. But there was, at one point, I think, 70 tornado warnings in effect for Florida, and it's just not near the storm. It's across much of Florida.
And, Dave, did it end up landing as a 3? Has it landed? I'm sorry, I'm not looking at the radar.
Yeah, it has not landed yet. The center of the storm, the eye is expanding a little bit, which you would expect. It's wobbling a little bit, also what you would expect. Landfall is probably about 4 or 5 hours away. It's about 90 miles to the southwest of Tampa right now. And it will tend to slow down. It has been moving very quickly today. But because now about, I would say 35 to 40% of it is over land as far as the whole circulation is concerned, hurricanes don't like that. They know that it's going to kill them. And so they tend to slow up and try to keep that support going as it gets closer and closer. And the other thing is, this will be a hurricane. And when it makes landfall, it's probably a strong 3, maybe a low 4. And the focus is still Tampa, St. Pete, down through about Point Charlotte, Port Charlotte. And, you know, it's an area that a lot of St. Louisans are very aware of. It's a hotbed for St. Louis folks to go vacation in. But this will still be a hurricane, probably a Category 1 as it passes close to Orlando and as it passes close to Daytona Beach. So this is a wide-range hurricane.
What's the difference, Dave? What's the difference, Dave, between this hurricane and Helene? And could this go up into any parts of North Carolina or Georgia?
No, this is not going to be a player for the Carolinas. It's only a player for Florida. Once it hits like the Daytona Beach area, it will go out over the Atlantic Ocean. It's not real favorable to stay strong at that point. There's a lot of wind shear on that side of Florida, so it should tend to fall apart. But this is not going to be a player for the southeast, other than the coastal areas of the southeast that will see some storm surges on the backside of it as it makes pops back out over the ocean. So this is not a concern for North Carolina or Tennessee or any place in the Ohio Valley, which that was an unusual situation. The difference in this storm is a little more compact than Helene was. Helene was a monster. It was like 600 miles wide at one point. This is big. There's no question about it. But they're two very different animals.
Dave, appreciate the update. So, you know, you're on the West Coast, but there's like even part of me that wants to stay up tonight and, you know, watch this thing. I'm guessing if you're in Florida, you're going to be watching some of the coverage. It's it'll be interesting.
Well,
but, you know, the other thing about it is, like, even if it does land as a three and the wind speeds are down, that doesn't necessarily minimize the impact because of all the flooding, correct?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. The storm surge is going to be tremendous. Also, with, you know, if let's say it has 115, 120 mile per hour wind gust in this thing. It also has a forward motion, probably as the eye makes landfall of 15 to 20 miles per hour. That's an added push to that thing. It's and that's why the worst part of this storm is to the east and to the northeast of the center of the eye.
All right. Well, listen, keep us posted. Thank you so much for the update this afternoon.
You got it.
And we are going to speak with Ryan Goble, who is the captain of a charter boat, a fishing boat down there. We're going to hook up with him. He's kind of waiting this thing out near Fort Myers. By the way, on a weather note, I just have to mention this because I was thinking about all of us yesterday. I think we've noticed this when you leave here. And if you're a friend of mine told me this story, my buddy Fitz was coming back from Pittsburgh, went and saw the Steelers game. And as he's coming across the poplar the other night, the sun angle is so severe.
It's brutal.
You couldn't even see. Like, I've experienced that a couple of times going home. And you guys will appreciate this, and maybe the audience too, but I know that you too will. I'm literally in my car yelling at the sun to F off. Like the sun's going to listen to me and do something different and not, you know, blast my eyes as much. That's how dumb I am. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah,
You can see me doing that, though, can't you, Fred?
Oh, yeah, I can. That's sort of MTG-like.
You know what? It kind of is. It's got to be somebody's fault that the sun is doing that, right? That's what I'm going to say. Let's do this.
These allegations are deeply concerning.
Does the president have any comment?
We're not going to comment.
It's not clear messaging.
No. And now, Sue's News. Brought to you by Sue.
On this day in history, 63 years ago, that's 1961, Fred.
Okay.
This song by Ray Charles peaked at number one on the singles chart. Oh. Oh, yeah.
Had a little bit of a slow start.
Yeah, I should have told him where to
start. Here it is.
That's my bad.
It sounds like a song from the early 60s,
doesn't it?
Yeah, I know. There's been a few updated versions, right?
Exactly. And that's why I put, just to contrast, this was the number two song at the same year on this day in history.
I was all right for a while.
It's all right for a while.
The music hasn't changed very much over the years.
No, really has. Isn't that crazy?
I do love Roy Orbison, though.
You gotta love Roy.
I got a little, we got a little Traveling Wilburys, I think, even this afternoon for the bumper music. If we don't have it today, Ethan, do you remember? I was thinking of Hurricane. Did I put Traveling Wilburys
I believe
today?
You did,
yeah.
Yes.
All right, we got a little Roy on that, then.
And on this day in history, 51 years ago, that's in 1973, that's when Elvis and Priscilla got divorced. They got divorced in Santa Monica, California. They were only really married for 6 years. And she was awarded nearly, now this is 1973, $1.5 million in cash and $4,200 a month alimony for 1 year, half the sale price of the couple's $750,000 home, and 5% interest in two of Elvis's publishing companies, which probably wasn't bad for back then. And I'm thinking, obviously, it was the house they sold was in California. So Graceland is
I did
still
not watch the Oprah thing last night. I do want to watch it. I just didn't have time last night. Busy with my daughter and was watching a little baseball. But it did seem, we talked about yesterday on the air during this segment, Sue, and it seemed rather intriguing.
Yeah. Okay, it was just reported that Carrie Underwood is paid $1 million every time this is played from NBC's Sunday Night Football. $1 million every time.
Okay, really?
Yeah.
Because when you started that, I thought, you know what? I can see her getting $1 million for the whole season for doing this song.
So you're saying it's like $18 million?
That is correct, Fred.
Wow.
God, that is
so
really
fired up,
amazing.
It's worth it.
But
so
while
good.
Ethan was pulling it, he's like, this really gets me fired up. See, that is why she gets $1 million every time.
Sue, I have goosebumps right now.
I do too.
How much does Stapleton get, you think?
Well,
nowhere near that much.
Million.
No way.
Well, you know, I always kind of have gut checks on this, and when things don't seem right to me, you know, I throw the challenge flag. Here's why this may seem right to me. You think about the amount of revenue that these football games are producing. Carrie's agents say, hey, well, I'm going to get a little chunk of that every time you play because it's a big part of the show. So I'm not so sure that that's inaccurate. Well, that's fascinating.
Even beyond that, that was just last year's. So she may make more in 2024. That was 2023 numbers. And she took over from, do you remember who did it up to 2013, my football peeps? Who was it?
Oh, it was the bearded. He was very, I can't think of his name. Great country singer.
I thought I heard it.
Faith Hill. It was Faith Hill, right?
Yeah. Oh, it was Faith Hill.
Yeah. Faith Hill. She took over for Faith Hill in 2013. All right, that means...
What's funny, though, is that became such a staple, and we struggled there to remember that Faith Hill did it.
Yeah,
it really.
Yes.
It was a big deal when she took over, though, when Carrie Underwood took over.
It was a big deal, right.
So
are you thinking of Chris Stapleton? He does the Monday Night Football.
Yeah, Monday.
That's what
he's
I'm thinking.
Monday.
That's what
but you have to remember, Fred, Monday and Sunday Night Football became kind of convoluted there for a while.
Yeah,
so it used to be Monday Night Football was the deal. Well, then they made it Sunday Night Football, but then they still do Monday Night Football.
Yeah.
So you have, and I like, Stapleton does the Phil Collins in the air tonight.
In the air tonight.
It's really good.
Okay, she just records these all at once, too. She goes in for each year all at once. She says, I do a whole main version, but then we go through and pick all the matchups for regular season and playoff football, and then I sing every possible combination of teams that could possibly play each other.
Yeah, because...
And put it in the can.
At the end of the year, they do these flex games, so they may not even have that game on the schedule yet, so they have to be prepared for that.
That's right. She's like, even in the back of your mind, you're like... There is no way these people are going to make it to the playoffs. I'm singing them versus everybody to try to get it in there.
You never know.
You $18 million bucks for one day's work. Not so bad. You go, Carrie Underwood.
it's no wonder that she can afford the personal trainers to get her body in that shape, right?
Man, if I had it, I would do the same thing. A big change, Fred found this story, is coming to Wimbledon in 2025.
The money or the body?
Well, either would be a surprise, Fred. Either would be a surprise. A big change coming to Wimbledon in 2025. The All England Club announced this week that it would replace human line judges with AI at next year's tournament. The AI system will handle out and fault calls and is built on ball tracking and line calling technology that's already in use. The club's chief executive, Sally Bolton, said the goal is maximum accuracy in our officiating.
Well, and it makes sense, but didn't we have in the U.S. Open, there was a situation
there was
where
one wrong call.
It didn't work, right?
I remember that, too. And I wonder if they've been watching all that. And just finally figured we'll give it a shot. Maybe there are human backups. I'm sure we review the tape or the non-tape.
AI learn from itself? So there you go.
Ugh, you're right. It does. And finally, in Sue's News, we have today's random fact. Okay. Pez dispensers originally looked like lighters and were marketed at adults as an alternative to smoking. What? I had no idea, but you can see it when you pull back the little head, it could be that. And that's it for Susan.
Well, so much of that is just muscle memory, right? So I get what they're going for.
Out comes a little candy. Sugar.
Reminds me of the Seinfeld scene where he puts it on Elaine's lap during the piano recital and she can't stop laughing.
We have Ryan Goebel, who is going to try to wait out this hurricane in Fort Myers. He's going to join us next on 97.1 FM Talk. All right, we still have a lot to get to here this afternoon. We're going to get back into the CBS News story, dressing down Tony DiCoppola on the morning show, which was fascinating. I got into that and played some of the audio yesterday, but Nicholas Fondacero, who's with Media Research Center, is going to join us. We got Kilmeade in the next hour. Also, George Rosenthal, our friend from ThrottleNet. We're going to talk a little bit about Starlink and how that works. In fact, we have maybe a real-life example of that here this afternoon, although we're trying to still arrange it. Ryan Goebel is the captain of Sea Trek 1, which is a charter fishing boat. It's down near Fort Myers. The owner of that ship is Deborah Donzi, who's with us this afternoon. We were trying to get Ryan on the line. Deborah, are you there?
I am, and actually my husband is on the phone, too. I conference called him, and he's in Ohio. So, Chuck, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, we're all over the country. That's pretty good. I like technology. The problem is we don't have Ryan on right now, right?
I know. And Chuck's been in constant contact with him, And I talked to him, and he said he would answer unless, and Chuck can tell you better what's going on there.
All right, Chuck, yeah, give us the update here. And is this smart to kind of stay down there and try to ride this out, I think would be one question.
Yeah, you know, they are, they're probably 8 to 10 miles inland up a river. So they're protected from the storm surge because they went past the first set of locks. So that is our hurricane plan for the boat, if you will, so that it's protected, you know, from the storm surge. Now, they'll still get wind and rain, but it won't be anything, you know, as bad as if you're right on the beach or right on the coast where you get that heavy, you know, anywhere from, you know, 6 foot plus storm surge. I mean, with Ian, we had almost 15 feet of storm surge at our dock, and it was, devastating.
Yeah, and I think we spoke with you guys a couple of years ago. That, I mean, that was 2 years ago, essentially last week, right? Right around the end of September when that came through.
Yep, September 28th.
And that boat got, if I remember that conversation, that thing got tossed around quite a bit down there, didn't it?
Yeah, it broke free, and we couldn't get up the river because the drawbridge for the railroad was down, and they wouldn't open it for us. But anyway, it broke free from the dock and went across the four-lane highway and was over in the mangroves.
What happened with Helene? And was there an impact with Helene? Obviously, a little bit different area, a different, you know, trek that this hurricane is taking. But did you have challenges there as well?
Helene, we had some flooding in at our dock. We didn't move the boat, but everything was fine there. We had some flooding. We probably had 4 foot of water over the seawall. And at our location there, we had some flooding and some cleanup. Nothing, no real major damage, just more cleanup than anything.
And Mark, no real damage because the house was already wiped out.
Well, yeah, that's true. There's no building. Well, there's no building there to damage anymore. So,
well, yeah, there is that. Now, how long have you guys been doing this down there in Florida? And I guess maybe my question would be, how much is this impacting your business now? Because it seems like the hurricanes, at least the past couple of years, have really increased.
Yeah. So it's a crazy story. So our son has been down there for 7-8 years, working for the SeaTrack charter boat, and it came up an opportunity that the previous owner was wanting to sell it, and so we kind of discussed it and talked about it, and we ended up buying it, and we actually signed the papers and bought it 3 weeks to the day before Hurricane Ian hit.
Oh, I remember that.
So then we went almost 9 months to get back in business. So obviously, you know, spending a lot of money on repairs, no revenue coming in. And yeah, so we've been doing it for a couple of years, a little over 2 years. But I, you know, I talked to locals down there, to Captain Kenny, who we bought the business from. He's been there his whole life. And I just asked him last week, I said, Kenny, have you ever seen anything like this where it's just these major hurricane after major hurricane? He said, no, I've never. As a matter of fact, we've taken the boat up the river now 3 times. And in 40 plus years, Kenny said he did it once.
Well, that says something right there. Hey, by the way, this is just a random question, but I was thinking about this. No one ever discusses this. What the hell happens to all these fish during a hurricane? And how long does that take to settle down before you can go back out there and fish again? You would think that there'd be severe damage to their, you know, infrastructure, but maybe not. You guys know?
Well, actually, from what I heard, and we weren't able to get out right after the hurricane the last time, but actually, from what I heard, the fishing was really good.
Fascinating. Well, maybe they get real hungry after that. They got to hunker down, and then they get hungry, right?
Well, that, and there's for quite a while, there's a lot less fishing pressure, people out fishing, because, you know, they've lost their boats and they can't get out there.
Well, that makes a difference, too. Absolutely. Well, at this point, so Deb, you're just kind of, you know, hoping that Ryan's okay, and you're going to, the Starlink, we're going to get a little explanation of that in the next hour. I don't know much about Starlink, but that's something that's helped you with communication here in the last couple of weeks?
Yep, we have Starlink on our boat, and what that does is when we're out, you know, we'll be out as far as, you know, 120, 130 miles offshore on some of these fishing trips, and obviously you have no cell phone coverage out there. So with Starlink, we've got Wi-Fi with Starlink, and you can do Wi-Fi calling, so, you know, we're able to stay in contact. And
that's amazing, isn't it?
That is amazing.
It really is.
While they're out there, yeah, it really is. And it's, before, you had to have a satellite phone.
Right.
And now we've got, not only do we have, you know, Wi-Fi calling, but they've got Wi-Fi on the boat. They can, you know,
watch movies and do whatever they want.
You tell me they don't have cell towers in the middle of the damn ocean? Come on. AT&T can't step up their game. That is really, that's incredible that that is providing, you know, so much advantage down there for sure. Well, thank you, too, for giving us the update this afternoon. We hope that Ryan's okay, and keep us posted, okay, Debbie?
Okay, I sure will.
Chuck, you too. Thank you so much for jumping on here.
All right.
Appreciate it. Wow. I mean, I don't even know. They're far away from all the action, but still, that would make me a little nervous. This guy's named Reed Timmer. He was on Fox, and he's a storm chaser. I think these guys are crazy. I saw some of the videos of one of the hurricane hunters. They were in the eye of Milton and just shaking around up there. This was a guy that went, you know, chasing down Helene.
I'm right in the eye of Category 4 Hurricane Helene. Winds are going to be gusting over 100 miles an hour shortly here.
All right, so that was a couple of weeks ago. Now in Tampa.
Well, I'm here in the downtown Tampa area, and it is a ghost town here. You can see a lot of boarding up that's happening. People have taken it very seriously in Tampa. There are gas shortages between Tampa and Orlando. You really can't get gas anywhere right now across these areas. And I'm just seeing chickens migrating throughout the streets of downtown Tampa here.
What?
But it looks like it is going to be trending a little bit south, and that exact track definitely is very important because wherever that comes ashore, the dirty side of the system is where the storm surge comes in. Right where that eye wall comes in at a perpendicular angle to the shoreline.
All right, so the chickens are on the loose down there as well. Now, he kind of addressed the differences between these two hurricanes, Helene and Milton.
Well, Helene definitely had that close upper-level low just upstream of it, so you had that Fujiwara interaction. Basically, it sucked Helene like a magnet due north, and that basically like a slingshot mechanism took it right up into the southern Appalachians, becoming a mega disaster up there in terms of flooding, a hydrological nightmare across that complex terrain of the southern Appalachians. This one has a much flatter trough upstream. It's barely a subtle little upper level system, and that's why it's taken more of an easterly track right over the Florida Peninsula and then eventually out to sea. So at least the good news is that it's not going to be pulled northward into the southern Appalachians where Helene hammered so hard.
So we had Dave Murray on earlier this hour. He has said, if I'm not mistaken, he's flown into the eyes of hurricanes, right? He's been on some of these planes.
Yes, he said it was awful.
This guy says he's going to do it for this one.
Yeah, my objective is to get in the eye. We have some new sensors that we're going to deploy, and my goal is to get a vertical sounding inside of the eye with these new high-resolution sensors. So our goal is definitely scientific and also to report as the conditions deteriorate across this area. Those people that evacuated like to see what's happening in their home after they get out. So we'll be covering that, the storm surge, and also deploying data inside of the eye.
Wow, there you go. Reed Timmer chasing down Milton. We're going to keep you posted throughout the next 24 to 48 hours. It could be a bad one tomorrow as this comes ashore in just about 4 hours. Sue is telling me that our friend and colleague Brad Young is reporting in from Highway 40 that it is a disaster this afternoon, right?
Yeah, that accident approaching 141 and they've got, you know, the two left lanes blocked. And that leaves only the right lane. I'm sorry, the two left lanes are the only ones open. The right lanes are blocked. He's been sitting there for 70 minutes.
But he's listening to the show, Sue.
Yeah.
He's doing the right thing. We appreciate that, Brad. Yesterday, I talked about the situation with CBS News. They held a big meeting on the anniversary of what happened with Hamas in Israel. The same day that Hamas parachutes into Israel, rapes, tortures, murders children, they decide to make this all about an interview that happened last week between Tony DeCoppel, their host for the morning show, one of their hosts with Gail King, and a guy by the name of Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is a liberal whack job who writes a book about Israel. And in this entire book, does not mention the word Hamas once, doesn't mention Iran, leaves all. So it's completely one sided, which certainly he has the right to do. But Tony DeCoppel has the right to ask him questions about that. So he does that. It's actually a pretty good interview. You know, and everyone seems to be fine.
Yeah.
But then the snowflakes at CBS decide to complain, all the little producers and editors and people that weren't happy with Tony. So they do a conference call with all their reporters and news staff, and here's what they say.
Many of you have reached out to express concerns over recent reporting, specifically about the CBS Morning's Coates interview from last week, as well as comments made coming out of some of our correspondents' reporting. I want to thank every single one who reached out for your honesty, your transparency, and your commitment. So I want to address three things. Number one, after a review of our coverage, including the interview, it's clear there are times we have not met our editorial standards.
Yeah, like last week with the debate, by the way. This is what's so funny, that they want to point toward this thing with Tony DeCoppa when they have all kinds of evidence, including Bill Whitaker, who came to St. Louis and completely manipulated and lied to the rest of the country about our prosecutor at the time, Kim Gardner. Nick Fondichero is with us. He is with the Media Research Center and Newsbusters. This is an interesting story, isn't it, Nick? How are you?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on, Mark.
You don't often get, and I don't know if anyone's going to try to out the person who leaked it, but it's funny. On that conference call, I'm sure you've listened to it, Sue, at the beginning, they say, we appreciate everyone keeping these conversations confidential. And somebody leaked the whole damn thing, didn't they, Nick?
Yeah, definitely. What's worse about it is that you can see when there is pushback from, like, Jan Crawford, where they're like, oh, no, he did a good job. And if you guys are getting these calls from people saying he's doing a bad job from inside the office, maybe I should be doing the opposite calls to let you know he's doing a great job. So he's getting some support on the inside, right? And you had Redstone come out today, one of their upper echelon people who doesn't deal with the day-to-day stuff at CBS, but it comes out and goes, oh, I thought the interview was really good. And this Redstone has a history of fighting anti-Semitism, so it makes sense that she would back Tony in this.
Yeah, so you're talking about Sherry Redstone, and this is interesting. You know, I think it's another interesting development, which, by the way, makes management at CBS in their news division just look terrible. So she's the chair of Paramount Global. That's the parent company. She said that CBS leadership had made a, quote, bad mistake with their handling of CBS Morning's co-host Tony DeCoppa's contentious interview last week. I give her credit for doing that, and it makes me wonder even more why these suits at CBS decided to do this on this conference call, because it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. What I want to hear more is about how the complaints came in and what specifically they were complaining about.
I think one of the complaints might have been they know when they were talking about, like, what happened with the interview. They're like, oh, that interview plus the sign-off with one of our correspondents, which before they went to that interview, Tony got into it a little bit with a foreign correspondent, India's Tayeb, who is fairly pro-Palestinian. He went around and did some really gushy interviews with Hamas terrorists that were released, and he's sitting there smiling. They're having a good time sitting and talking about getting released. And when Tayeb was doing a report sort of lamenting Hezbollah getting bombed in Lebanon, Tony basically said, like, oh, they got what was coming to them after launching rockets for a year at Israel. And you see, like, an active grimace on Tayeb's face when he hears that. So if I was to put money on somebody, it might have been Tayeb.
Right, right. And maybe more than that. But look, what the reporting has been is that there has been strong and growing discord within CBS News that needed to be addressed in the editorial meeting. But what's hilarious about it, as you know better than anyone, especially at Newsbusters, that they say this all with a straight face, completely not acknowledging the bias that took place 2 weeks ago or just a week ago in the vice presidential debate or any other of litany of things that CBS has been involved in an embarrassing way over the course of the last couple of decades, I'd say.
Yeah, like they're definitely, like what we saw in the debate where Tim Walz was able to get away with stuff. Meanwhile, they were trying to actively fact check Vance when they were literally trampling the rules of their debate, when their debate rule said, we're not going to fact check. That's going to be up to the candidates to make their points to each other. And they were trampling all over those rules. And it's like this massive double standard, because even on CBS Mornings, there's this double standard where they said in the meeting, oh, Tony was essentially bringing his personal feelings to it because he has children over his he has a couple children from a previous marriage that live in Israel, so he brought his personal baggage to the table here. But during the George Floyd stuff, you had Gayle King bringing her personal baggage and getting close to breaking down in tears over what happened. So there's this double standard that Tony's not going to be able to bring his stuff and show
Talk
about his lived experience.
But she can. She can bring all the emotion. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was nothing. I watched the interview. There was nothing that was unprofessional. He was very honest in the way that he was handling the question. They even highlighted in the CBS, and apparently they tried to dress him down in an hour-long meeting, but I don't think it went very well. And you mentioned Jan Crawford, Sue. Jan Crawford was the only one, at least on the call that we heard, that, you know, stood up for mm-hmm. him. But it's also a situation where, again, CBS, of all places, when it comes to bias in the media, and I don't know if you ever read or if you're familiar with Bernie Goldberg. Bernie's a friend. I've known him for a long time. He was a longtime CBS News reporter. And, you know, this, I'm guessing you're a little younger than I am, Nick, but in 2001, Bernie Goldberg wrote a book called Bias. A CBS insider exposes how the media distorts the news. And he laid it out for everyone. And he's been pretty much one of the experts on media bias for the last couple of decades. And he was way ahead of the game. So this does not surprise me with CBS News, which makes it even more comical that they tried to take the stand in the position that this was all about, you know, journalistic integrity, if you will. No, it's about upper management getting scared because of a bunch of snowflakes complaining about their coverage of Israel. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah, especially when they have, like, again, a lot of that is coming from the younger people that they're getting out of these journalism schools now, coming out of college, where they're not taught to be objective and show sides to a story, that they're taught to be activists in their journalism, right? Like, that's what Coates was all about. It's like, oh, I'm only going to show the Palestinian side here because I think personally the Israel side gets too much attention in the media. Meanwhile, we know that the media leans towards the Palestinian cause anyway.
You know, this reminds me, I always talk about some of these local cases that come up, but we had, last year I had a little dust up with a local reporter, might have even been earlier this year, who's at our local NBC affiliate. One of the things that I thought was interesting is that when we were exchanging messages back and forth, and this was about some of the gender-affirming care stuff, she said something on her Twitter feed along the lines of, you know, I'm a very proud and loyal ally to the LGBTQ plus, you know, community. And my response was, wait a second, how can you have a reporter who declares her allegiance to identity politics covering a story that relates to identity politics? By the way, the answer to that is it shouldn't happen. But this is what journalism has become. They're not embarrassed by it at all. In fact, they're proud of it at local television stations and newspapers. And this is what they do. And this is how they're educated, I guess, or indoctrinated was the word I should have used there.
Yeah, journalists are supposed to be dispassionate observers and presenters of the facts and presenters of the events that are going on around us. And we see this even earlier, I believe it was this year, CBS showed us where they lie on good journalism, right? They fired Catherine Herridge, amazing investigative journalist, massive Rolodex. She checks her stuff, she checks her work, and then they got rid of her because she may lean to the right slightly or covers topics that they find problematic, like the Hunter Biden stuff and whatnot.
Look, I can tell you, I have a, well, used to be a very close friend of mine who's now, because of his choice, a former friend. He's one of the suits at CBS News, and I can certainly share more stories beyond what you heard on that conference call yesterday. Nick, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have a great week.
Thanks for having me on.
Kilmeade's coming up in the next hour.
Get more at 971talk.com.